is giving a course for the next, well, every Tuesday night for the next semester, so he won't be able to be here. So I want to ask how many visitors are here with us for the first time. That's wonderful, wonderful. How did you hear about us?
I heard about from a coworker of mine that has been as well.
Great.
I get the emails that come
emails
about the medical ethics.
Okay. Anybody hear us on Meetup or
website?
Yes, Meetup.
Good. Great.
Website.
Thank you. All right. So there's a few little, stuff to take care of. Make sure you pay the treasurer. That's me. But Carl is going to take the money for a while. Philosophy isn't free. We do have our expenses. And make sure you pay your bill. The tip is not included, so take care of your server before you go. And turn off your phones. Put your phones on hold. We have a program in the summertime. Usually in the summer. We did last summer, called Philosopher's Jeopardy, and it's kind of a light Jeopardy, but the subjects are on a philosophical subject. And we have three colleges that in the area that compete with one another. This year it's going to be SMU, UT Arlington, and University of Dallas. And we have their professors coach them, and then we have two usually graduate students or two students of the philosophy department with representing them. And we have this nice little program called Philosopher's Jeopardy, and that's going to be on May the 26th. Just like last year, we asked for contributions and sponsors to help us, and we still, lost a little money. So this year we're going to ask for more, the same contributors or sponsors or even more as we get along. And your name will be in the program, a little business card thing, or your name, depending on how much you give. Anyway, that's a lot of fun. Put that on your calendar, and you'll get more information on it. It's going to be on a Tuesday at 7 o'clock, May the 26th. Our speaker tonight is Dr. John Sadler of the University of Texas Southwestern Medical School. He received his BS degree in psychology from SMU, and then his MD degree from the University School of Medicine, Indiana. Did his internship and residency in psychiatry at UT Southwestern, where he was chief resident. And since his residency, he's joined the faculty, and he's been on the faculty at Southwestern ever since then.
That was 30 years ago.
30 years ago. Wow. I know. Don't ask me how long I've been. His main research area has been in philosophy and ethics. He's a co-editor of an international journal, Philosophy, Psychiatry, and Psychology. That's a pretty interesting combination. The current opinion in psychiatry section on history and philosophy, and the Oxford University Press book series, International Perspectives on Philosophy and Psychiatry. He recently finished a book, a large textbook for Oxford University Press, The Oxford Handbook of Philosophy and Psychiatry, and is the lead editor of the forthcoming Oxford Handbook of Psychiatric Ethics, which is your main interest. He's edited or co-edited four books, comprehensive monograph, Values and Psychiatric Diagnoses. And in collaboration with philosopher Jennifer Radin, The Virtuous Psychiatrist, Character Ethics in Psychiatric Practice. And now he has his follow-up book, Values and Psychiatric Diagnosis, Vice and Psychiatric Diagnosis, is in preparation. So join me in welcoming Dr. John Sadler. Thank you, John.
Yeah, you got me plugged in.
You got your plug in.
So is this working now?
Yes.
Okay, everybody, can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
So, David, thank you very much for that kind introduction. And it's always a pleasure to come here and share with you. I should tell you a little bit more about myself. I'm a bit of a different stripe in psychiatry because of my interest in philosophy that's going on for a long time, for many years, for 30 years or more. I've helped to develop a whole interdisciplinary, I guess you would say, movement of philosophers and psychiatrists that sort of cross-collaborate with each other. I'm just going to say that as a note of introduction. But the best way to give you a sense of what kind of work we do is for me to share some of it with you. This is very recent stuff that actually I just gave a very similar lecture to this one to a bunch of colleagues in at the Free University in Amsterdam. I'm a little bit jet-lagged with that. So if I get a little dizzy, please bear with me. So let me tell you a little bit about what I want to do. I'm going to explain to you some new ideas, or at least what I think are new ideas. The most important one is what this thing I'm calling folk metaphysics. I'm going to explain to you what that is and why I think it's important and how it sheds some light on some philosophical problems. Hi, Ollie. I didn't see you back there. Some philosophical problems that have haunted psychiatry and law for a long time. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the relationship between psychiatry and law. That's what number two here is about. I'll talk about these two major varieties and the ramifications, and then I'll apply some of these ideas to certain problems in mental health and its relationship with things like crime and public attitudes. So I'm particularly, as this many of you are not professional philosophers, and only a couple of you are professional psychiatrists or would be professional psychiatrists, I'm really looking forward to your comments. So first of all, I'm going to tell you what folk metaphysics is. How many here have ever heard one of your philosophy colleagues talk about folk psychology? Folk psychology. Okay, you're the card-carrying philosopher. There we go. Okay, so fair enough. So folk psychology is a very common and somewhat popular, I guess you would say, concept in philosophy of mind. And in this new field of cognitive science. And if you go, this is a very nice resource, the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, for just sort of getting the mainstream view in philosophy. Folk psychology has to do with three things, according to this guy, Ravenscroft. The first aspect, or framework for it, is a particular set of cognitive capacities to explain or predict behavior. Secondly, a theory of behavioral representations in the brain mind. And then third, which is the one I find closest to folk metaphysics or most adaptable, is from philosopher David Lewis. There's a Steve Pike is a photographer. He's done a very nice book of portraits of well-known philosophers. David Lewis says that folk psychology is psychological theory constituted by platitudes about the mind's function held by ordinary people. So what Lewis means here is that when we talk about our everyday sorts of reasons for doing things or motivations or explaining our own behavior, we use what we call folk psychology, or what Lewis calls folk psychology. When I say, the reason I yelled at my wife is because she lied to me, that's an example of sort of folk psychological reasoning. What makes it folk is that there's nothing scientifically theory-driven about it. It's everyday, commonsensical sorts of ways of explaining human behavior and motivations and so forth. Does that make sense?
It would be so far. Good.
So this last aspect about psychological theory, about platitudes of the mind's function held by ordinary people, is the folk part of folk metaphysics. So in philosophy of science, some philosophers of science like to talk about domesticated science. And what domesticated science is another way, is a way of talking about folk science. That is, when we as ordinary people go through school and get our high school or college education, but don't become scientists ourselves, we develop certain general understandings about science and how science works. That's what Lewis and others talk about in terms of domesticated science. It's sort of our ordinary layperson's understanding of science. So that then brings me to folk metaphysics. And this little book here, which you can't read, is titled Folk Metaphysics, and it's not what I have to do with. Some of you may live near or frequent, shops that are metaphysics shops, but this is not what I'm talking about here. I'm not talking about herbs and crystals. I'm not talking about, you know, Wiccan psychology. I'm talking about something explicitly philosophical. So that's this kind of folk metaphysics is not what I'm talking about. So what do I mean by folk metaphysics? Here's my definition right here. The definition is, if in case those in the back can't see it, cultural assumptions about the nature of reality and existence, what it means to be human, and of more specific interest, the sources of morality. So again, this is pretty much a general lay sort of definition of metaphysics in philosophy. You probably heard about the branches of metaphysics, ontology and epistemology. That's what has to do with the nature of reality, existence, what it means to be human, and to a lesser extent, sources of morality. What's different about what's the folk in folk metaphysics is these are cultural assumptions. That's what I'm going to talk about in more detail. So the characteristics of folk metaphysics are these. The first I want to talk about is they're unsystematic, especially compared to philosophical metaphysics. You've probably heard philosophers talk about the systematic metaphysicians like Hegel or Heidegger or Hume and so forth. These are people who are doing very deliberate, careful, systematic philosophical metaphysics. Folk metaphysics is unsystematic. That is, if you ask a guy on the street, what's your system of what's your set of metaphysical assumptions, they're going to give you really dumb looks, or perhaps worse. So the other thing is they're naively assumed and rarely questioned, as opposed to philosophical metaphysics. What naively assumed means is that we just go about our ordinary business and we don't think about what the nature of reality is, and, you know, what am I doing here, what is human nature. Those are not things that we preoccupy ourselves in an ordinary sense every day. So we sort of just go ahead and go about our business. That's the naive assumption part. The other, this is very important, they're shared by a diverse human community, but only partially. And so there'll be lots of disagreements about folk metaphysical assumptions. You probably heard about other sorts of cultural differences. So, for example, we have this old saying called the squeaky wheel gets the grease. You've heard that, right? Yeah. So squeaky wheel means to get the grease in United States means that if you raise hell, then you get what you want, or you make trouble, right? Well, in Japan, they have a similar expression that's called, the nail that sticks out gets hammered down. And it has to do with the different sorts of folk metaphysical assumptions. That is, in Japan, if you make trouble as an individual and don't conform to the community, then you get yourself into trouble. While in the United States, where we have great respect for individualism and respect the renegade, pull your boots up guy, then you get the grease. So here we have a very simple sense of individualism versus communalism in Japan and the United States that are folk metaphysical assumptions that are pretty distinctive. Folk metaphysics are anthropological. And so I've already suggested these have to do with cultural, religious, and ethnic traditions. So what we say in philosophy is that some ideas are theory-laden. So if I talk about reinforcement contingencies, that means I'm drawing upon behaviorism as a theory. But if I talk about the nail that sticks out gets hammered down, rather than being theory-laden, that's culture-laden. Does that make sense?
Right.
Then lived by, this is crucially important. Folk metaphysical beliefs are normatively powerful. What that means is these are really compelling. People live their entire lives in according to their folk metaphysical belief or assumptions, even though they may not even be able to articulate them. The classic example is people have various religious faiths that they take at face value. They don't argue with other people. They don't derive them logically and so forth. People nevertheless live by them, and those religious beliefs are very important. That's the lived by aspect. The sixth aspect is what I call they're imbricated in institutions. This is a Supreme Court building. So folk metaphysical assumptions structure how we think about things. And I'm going to get into this in very explicit detail later, so I'm just going to mention that. And it could be legal, politically, government, scientific, you name it. I talk about folk metaphysics underwriting theory. And so I say that all psychologies, whether they're scientific or popular or folk psychologies, have metaphysical assumptions. And because they require metaphysical assumptions, as we have to make certain assumptions about what the nature of reality is before we can even start to talk about scientific psychology, folk metaphysics then underwrite these scientific as well as folk psychologies. And again, you'll get a sense of that later as I develop this lecture. I've already mentioned that folk psychology in a certain sense could even be substituted for common sense. And so folk metaphysical assumptions, like, for example, the core unit of how we think about the mind is through the individual, they structure our common sense and our ordinary intuitions about things. Folk metaphysics are pragmatic. That is, everybody has to have folk metaphysical assumptions that are really required for action. So the example I give to my residents is, right, you see those two doors back there, right? Okay, they're closed. Now, you all probably would take for granted that if we were to open up those doors, we would see the other room, the other dining room up in the El Phoenix here, right? But that's an assumption, right? It's possible, it's conceivable that we open up those two doors, we would be on the top of a building and it would drop straight down 10 stories. Or we could be in outer space. And so the idea here is we don't act like that's possible. We have to make certain assumptions about the way the world is, the way it operates, in order for us to do our everyday activities. Now, folk metaphysical assumptions are problematized by philosophy, and so metaphysicians, the people who specialize in metaphysical theory and so forth, will challenge various aspects. So, for example, one of the old saws in philosophy to argue about is so-called dualism, Cartesian dualism, the idea that we have this physical substance, this physicality, this materiality that somehow, when it comes to our brains, does these intangible things like 2 + 2 = 4, or the sum of the angles of a triangle are 180 degrees, these immaterial ideas. How is that possible? So these are things that metaphysicians reflect about and discuss, but not... most of you probably are at trouble on a day-to-day basis about the mind-body problem, would be my guess. I'm certainly not. And then the other thing is they're deeply assumed. So until this lecture, you probably never ever thought about folk metaphysics or this idea before. And so now your life has changed forever. Okay, so what folk metaphysical beliefs is that this is underscoring the diversity idea. I just have some people that are going to have a lot of different ideas about folk metaphysical beliefs. And so we have this woman, you know, the woman with the dragon tattoo, but in this case I think it's the Krishna tattoo. We have a bunch of theoretical physicists here. We have the Association of Women Psychiatrists here. We have some Southern Baptists here. I think these are some Surinam Muslims. We got some Hasidim here, and I guess this is the Pope or something going on here with the Roman Catholicism. So we got lots of diversity, and so these folk metaphysical beliefs really make up a diverse cultural fabric. So now I've told you about what it is, I want to now give you some what I call expressions of folk metaphysical assumptions. So this is key here, expressions and assumptions. Remember that these are not, folk metaphysics doesn't deal with the realm of belief. It's the assumptions that we make, that we make our beliefs on. So I can't say these are examples of folk metaphysics because they're not examples, they're expressions and assumptions. So for example, the Lord is my Savior is an example. That's from the religious arena, but then from the scientific arena, we have everything has a cause. What sort of respectable scientists would refute the idea that things have a cause, unless they're perhaps a theoretical physicist? A third is God is all-powerful and all-knowing, and time does not exist for him. That's a pretty radical statement. That's certainly different than what one would expect from most scientists. One that I'm going to be talking about later here is people can freely choose for themselves. That is that we have free will. That's a metaphysical assumption. I'm alone and responsible for my salvation. So in Judeo-Christian metaphysics, I guess you would say, the idea is that I'm responsible for my salvation. It's somebody else's. It's my actions, but I'll be judged for entry into the kingdom of heaven. Metaphysics, the sixth example is metaphysics of mind-brain is conformed to my intuition. This is actually straight from Lewis, the philosopher. And so the question there is, why would that be? Why did the metaphysics of the mind, the brain, have to conform to my intuitions? Couldn't my intuitions be wrong? Morality cannot develop in children without religious guidance. That's a very, again, a very common Christian religious belief in some groups. Here's another one of legal significance. Criminal guilt or innocence is not graded. It's either or. So in the courts, the way the courts, criminal courts work in the United States today, you're not just sort of guilty. You're either guilty or you're not. There's no in-betweens. Now, if you think about psychiatrists don't think that way, and we're going to hear more about that here shortly. Here's another example from science. It's a metaphysical assumption. Electrons are real, and this plays out in philosophy courses all the time. Are electrons really real? Are they things that are out there, like this chair or this pointer? Or are they theoretical ideas. I mean, how many of you have seen an electron? So, or tasted one? The closest you've had is in, you know, fourth grade when your teacher brushed your hair and it stood on end. That's about as close to seeing an electron as you're ever going to get. Now, here's one from Confucius, of all people. A nation can be guided only by custom, not by knowledge. It's another sort. So again, so now, so I've told you what Volkmann physics are. I've given you some expressions to give you a sense of what folk metaphysical assumptions, what kinds of thoughts or beliefs folk metaphysics underlie or drive. So how do they differ from philosophical metaphysics? So philosophical metaphysics aspires to the following things, and folk metaphysics doesn't. So folk metaphysics doesn't aspire to have a systematic account because they're taken for granted. Again, you don't walk around and say, well, you know, it's really inconsistent for me to think that, that you know, the devil made me do it on the one hand, and that I, you know, went off my Prozac on the other, and that's why I'm feeling bad. We don't worry about those things, but philosophers do. Philosophers want to have a systematic account that's sophisticated, scholarly, rigorous, and comprehensive. Again, the ordinary person doesn't reflect upon their full metaphysical assumptions. Philosophy is self-critical. That's one of the marks for me of good philosophy is when you're doing your essay, you try to find the holes in your own argument and then provide your own counterexamples and treatment to your own critical reflection. Philosophical metaphysics aspires to be true or at least credible. People have their folk metaphysical assumptions. They just live their lives, and they don't really care. They base their lives on them and conduct them regardless. And then the other thing philosophical metaphysics tries to do is that it tries to be culture independent. So it would be very disturbing for philosophical metaphysicians to say, well, this may hold for North Texas, but it doesn't hold for South Texas or for France or for Japan. So they try to make it culturally independent, not culturally relative account. Philosophical metaphysics behaves differently than folk metaphysics, too. It tends to be abstract as opposed to folk metaphysics, which is sort of practical and needs to be taken for granted. Philosophical metaphysics often fails to assimilate scientific knowledge. It's a very interesting group from James Ladyman and Don Ross, Everything Must Go, is a discussion about how philosophical metaphysics has tended to, over the past 150 years of modern science, ignore very important scientific findings that are inconsistent with some of the classic metaphysical treatments of various problems. Philosophical metaphysics, practical applications in everyday life, are pretty impoverished. And so again, I would imagine most of you don't say, well, you know, what would Hegel do in this situation? Or maybe I should think about how Heidegger would handle this problem. So philosophical metaphysics is not very practical. And it's also imbricated in institutions rarely and then by happenstance. So I mentioned Cartesian dualism, and so it's not like we have built in it's not like our institutions in science or in law, for that matter, have said, you know, we really think Descartes got it right, and so we're going to have Cartesian dualism in our law. It doesn't work that way. So Dr. Alkick mentioned the book Values of Psychiatric Diagnosis, and this is a reference that is probably not terribly interesting to y'all. I just want to mention it in passing. That I'm working on a follow-up to a book called Vice and Psychiatric Diagnosis. And this book I'm working on considers this problem in psychiatry that we have. So psychiatrists like to think that mental illness is like any other sort of disease, and oftentimes that's indeed the case. But then we have in our official diagnostic manual, the DSM, certain diagnostic categories that resemble criminal or immoral conduct. And so from Sadler's perspective, psychiatrists are sort of mixed up about whether we're in the business of taking care of sick people or policing immoral or wrongful conduct. So for example, we have